headlines this hour. On the first anniversary of the deadly attack on the U.S. Capitol, the residents of Washington, D.C. remain concerned about the divisions in American society.
But no one really just talked about it as much, and now people feel like they have a platform, so it seems like we're more divided, but it's probably always just been like this.
U.S. President Joe Biden accuses his predecessor Donald Trump of being a threat to America's democracy. And dozens of anti-government protesters are killed, and some 2,300 are detained, as unrest continues in Kazakhstan's largest city, Almaty. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Muse. Thanks for joining us. January 6, 2021 marks a dark day in the U.S. history. Thousands of people supporting former President Donald Trump stormed the Capitol building in a bid to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election. Now, 1 year after the riots, Americans have been sharing their thoughts on the incident and its indication for the country's unity. Let's hear what they have to say.
I really believe that this country has been divided like since the Trump administration, and after Biden was elected, it still has like a little sense of division.
I think there's definitely some political divide happening in our country right now. That's going to take some time to get over what happened. Obviously, with the year anniversary coming up, it's a good remembrance for what happened, and hopefully it's an opportunity for us to heal as a country and remember what happened that day and the lives that were lost. And hopefully we can use that as something to come together.
I feel like there are still a lot of people who have not changed their minds in the last years about a lot of things. Be that racial justice or COVID or any of the other issues, the election.
Probably have always just been divided, but no one really just talked about it as much. And now people feel like they have a platform. So it seems like we're more divided, but it's probably always just been like this.
U.S. President Joe Biden accuses his predecessor Donald Trump of spreading lies to overturn his 2020 election defeat.
And here's the truth. The former president of the United States of America has created and spread a web of lies about the 2020 election. He's done so because he values power over principle, because he sees his own interest as more important than his country's interest, than America's interest.
Biden made the remarks as he marked the first anniversary of the deadly attack by Trump's supporters on the Congress building. Speaking at the scene of the January 6th riots, Biden accused Trump of posing a continuing threat to American democracy. He noted that Trump was the first president in U.S. history to try to prevent the peaceful transfer of power. Donald Trump immediately issued a statement in response, accusing Biden of trying to further divide America.
A new report has warned about the rising threat of extremism in the United States. The report has been prepared by the Atlantic Council's Digital Forensic Research Lab. It says that 12 months after the attack on the Capitol by a pro-Trump mob, far-right groups were traced and arrested by police and federal authorities. But it says other groups have reorganized, often with an emphasis on local-level politics. It found that domestic extremist groups have recruited and spread their messages through culture war debates, including vaccines, race, and education. It says groups such as Proud Boys and QAnon conspiracy movement have re-emerged in recent months. They have made progress by shifting to alternative online platforms, embracing rhetoric to engage more broadly with the mainstream conservative base, and engaging in new political activities, particularly public health and education issues at the local level. The report says extremist movements were filled with paranoia following the Capitol riot. It notes that members are suspicious of each other and law enforcement. That has discouraged many members from attending public events.
They morph into different forms and formations, but they tend to follow the same basic tenets, which are white nationalism. So whether we're talking about the Ku Klux Klan or the White Citizens Council or the Oath Keepers, white Southern Baptists or neo-Nazis, the American history is replete with these types of organizations.
These extremist groups have adopted smaller and less sophisticated platforms, and that made them vulnerable to data scrapes, breaches, and hacks. The report warns of the rise of far-wing influencers inside these alternative social media platforms and the dangers that they could bring. Far-right figures like the former top Trump aide Stephen Bannon have encouraged a precinct-by-precinct strategy. It refers to a ground-up approach that focuses on local politics.
In 2022, Ronald Reagan's so-called shining city on the hill has become exposed as a mirage, as the poor, the elderly, and people of color are still fighting in 2022 for one person, one vote.
Well, the Capitol riot is already a dark day in the U.S. calendar. Law enforcement forces are very wary of the potential violence that may break out on the anniversary of the occasion. Five people lost their lives, over 100 officers were injured, and bombs were found nearby on the day mobs of Trump supporters attacked Capitol Hill, all attesting to the level of extremism that exists in the U.S.
The report comes as the U.S. prepares to remember the first anniversary of the Capitol Hill riot. During the January 6th riot, thousands of supporters of former President Donald Trump attacked police, vandalized the Capitol, and sent members of Congress and then Vice President Mike Pence running for their lives. Democrats have been arguing that the riot on January 6th was an insurrection based on disinformation spread by Trump, who alleges that he is the true victor of the 2020 presidential election and not Joe Biden.
As an economic system, based on unbridled capitalism, the system eventually has to implode. The insatiable lust for markets, the insatiable lust for resources and profits cannot be sustained.
A new poll has found that 60% of Americans believe Trump's level of responsibility for the attack was either a great deal or a good amount. Trump is often cited by U.S. media as the one inciting his supporters to storm the Congress premises in the hope of overturning the election results. A committee tasked with investigating the events of the January 6th riot has issued dozens of subpoenas to Trump's current and former associates.
These folks are well-funded, they are very well organized, but I don't think that they are in large enough numbers to where they can really take over the government in the manner in which, you know, in terms of a civil war and that kind of thing. I think that's a bit rhetorical. I think that's a bit of hyperbole.
At least 7 people died in the incident, including a police officer, and more than 700 have been arrested so far for crimes related to the breach.
Frank Emspach, Emeritus Professor, University of Wisconsin, joins us now from Madison. We have heard the U.S. President speak about this day, of which he marked just, a couple hours ago, and he believes that the former U.S. President Donald Trump is a threat to democracy, perhaps a notion that he believes he is also currently a threat to U.S. democracy. Do you agree with him?
I agree with President Biden. I think that that former president made it very clear that he believes that he has the right to the presidency, and he also believes that there are extrajudicial ways for him to secure that. So clearly, you know, he's been mobilizing people in various ways, both legal and illegal, to make that point.
Okay, do you think that that's right, that he's doing that, given the fact that we have seen what this day last year brought about?
Well, I don't think he's right. I think the question is that he has, as President Biden said, a desire for power. Clearly, in 200 years, no other president has done what he has done in terms of trying to disrupt the process. Even during the American Civil War, the South recognized the legitimacy of the election. And they said, well, we don't accept it. And then they left. They seceded. But they didn't say the election was a fraud. And that's what's really different here. President Nixon, the same way. He, eventually was forced from office, but he did not contest the legitimacy of the election. And what former President Trump has done, which is much different, is contest the legitimacy of the election and put into question the election. And therefore, if the election is fraudulent, he has the right to intervene. That is a completely different thing this time around than any other time in American history.
Well, is the election process also in question here?
The election process is in question. The issue of the Electoral College is in question. And the fact that it's possible in this country for a person to accede to the presidency with a minority of votes. That's what happened with Trump. Hillary Clinton had 3 million more votes than President Trump did. And the fact of the matter is that Trump's votes were in certain states so he could put together a victory in the Electoral College, which I'm sure is obscure to most of the listeners here. But in fact, in the United States, we have indirect election of the president. We do not have one person, one vote system for the election of the president.
So moving forward, if the election process itself is somewhat in question, I'm guessing that many in the U.S. believe that, then does that put at risk another election and the results to come out and the way that people will react given what Americans have experienced?
Most experienced political commentators in the United States believe now that with approximately a third of the population thinking the process is certainly questionable, if not fraudulent, and 70% of Republicans saying it is fraudulent, that we are in a situation where a significant number of people are going to say that the next election is no good, doesn't count, it's fraudulent, and doesn't mean anything, will not be followed. And many commentators believe that that in itself will result in the disruption of the election process in certain states.
So to cap this off, doesn't this mean that there is not a functioning democracy in the U.S.?
No, I think it means that the issue is still in question. You have the President of the United States, the Vice President of the United States, the Joint Chiefs of Staff. I mean, that has never happened. Saying, listen, we're in trouble in this country. We have to be vigilant. We cannot allow this to happen. I think that that's not clear yet. Now, if the next election is disrupted, clearly your statement would be accurate, but I don't think that that's in the bag yet. I think that, in fact, there are the majority of people in this country who do not want to see an extra legal process and who want to see the proper conduction of elections. Whether that will happen or not is another question.
And all of the things that we talked about, I'm guessing, logically, it should be under peaceful setting, whether it's at somebody's house, whether it's in the Congress. But what we saw last year spoke otherwise. How did it lead to that?
It led because for the first time in history, a sitting president said, the election is fraudulent. I'm not going to recognize the successor, my successor. We should fight. And that's how we had the immediate issue at the Congress or at the Capitol. But I mean, leading up to it, starting really almost a year ahead of time, then President Trump began to raise issues about the election, claiming that there were problems. So he worked hard to set this up. This was not a spontaneous upheaval.
All right, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much, Frank Emspach, Emeritus Professor at the University of Wisconsin. Many thanks. What's obviously a day that marks the assassination of Haji Qasem Soleimani, or Martyr Soleimani, and the commander of the IRGC Quds Force there, Brigadier General Ismail Ghani, was making his statements. He talked about how Haji Qasem Soleimani was a great friend and comrade. Any gathering for one martyr belongs to all martyrs. Spoke at length about martyrs of resistance, for example, in different fronts and in different areas. He talked about how those who are sacrificing their lives are standing in the face of resistance. In the other end of the spectrum, those people are an embarrassment. Resistance is a respected term. And Iran is one of the countries that has shown the path of resistance. One example that he used for Iran to have done that was during what he called the 8 years of the Holy Defense, which is the 8-year war with Iraq. Resistance is not limited to just defense, he said. Then he talked about how Iran under sanctions for 40 years has actually helped other countries like Lebanon, again, a resistance front there. He talked also about how he says that Iran had warned the U.S. not to enter this region. They did not pay attention to the countries when they came into this region, and they perpetrated crimes across the region. The U.S. must know that if they are wise, he said, the resistance front has no boundaries, and they will take revenge. So in a sense, he was building up to that notion there. And he says that that has already started. He said all Americans will be eradicated from this region. Like from Iraq, the resistance front will obviously be active in that regard. So some of the statements there are made by the replacement of Marcher Soleimani, General Ismail Khani. On to Kazakhstan. Security forces use a force to disperse protesters on the fifth day of a deadly unrest triggered by soaring fuel prices. Reports say soldiers have opened fire on protesters and cars on the main square of the largest city, Almaty. Security officials say that dozens of people were killed in clashes with police as they attempted to storm government buildings. According to officials, nearly 2,300 people have also been arrested. They also say a total of 18 police officers have been killed and around 750 others injured in the violence. Protesters say that the rise in fuel prices is unfair, given Kazakhstan's vast energy reserves. In response, the government has set limits on the prices for 6 months, but street protests continue unabated. And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
Diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The world's 10 richest billionaires added roughly $402 billion to their collective wealth in 2021, a year marked by continued suffering and economic dislocation fueled by the global coronavirus pandemic. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading, In 2022, Let's Tax the Rich, 10 billionaires added $402 billion to their fortunes in 2021. Stay tuned for more. The world's 10 richest billionaires added roughly $402 billion to their collective wealth in 2021, a year marked by continued suffering and economic dislocation fueled by the global coronavirus pandemic. Heading into 2022, the 10 wealthiest individuals in the world are all worth more than $100 billion, CNBC noted, citing the Bloomberg Billionaires Index, which tracks and ranks the fortunes of the planet's richest people. Representative Pramila Jayapal, the chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, said recently that the staggering growth of billionaire wealth amid the worldwide public health emergency and economic crisis should compel Congress to finally redress the fundamental injustices of the U.S. tax system. Jayapal said, in 2022, let's tax the rich and invest in our communities. At the top of the billionaires index at the close of 2021 was Tesla and SpaceX CEO Elon Musk, who added over $121 billion to his wealth last year as the pandemic both took and completely upended lives, pushing tens of millions of people into poverty and intensifying pre-existing inequities. Just behind Musk on the list was former Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos, who tacked $5 billion onto his net worth in 2021, leaving him with a total fortune of $195 billion. In November, the head of the World Food Program, WFP, outlined a proposal by which Musk, now the richest man in the world, and other U.S. billionaires could donate just 0.36% of their pandemic wealth gains to help 42 million people facing starvation. The $6.6 billion required would help those in most need in the following way. One meal a day, the basic needed to survive, costing 43 dollars per person per day. Averaged out across the 43 countries, the WFP said this would feed 42 million people for 1 year and avert the risk of famine. The billionaires have not taken the WFP up on its modest plan to save millions of lives with a fraction of their pandemic profits. The investigative outlet ProPublica reported in June that Musk, along with other U.S. billionaires, paid $0 in federal income taxes in 2018. Late last year, Musk garnered widespread publicity for selling off a portion of his Tesla stock, triggering a significant taxable event. But as Bob Lord, an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, observed in a recent blog post, Musk has paid tax in 2021, lots of it because doing so was by far his best option. Did he pay more tax than any American in history, as he claims? Probably Lord wrote, but he also received compensation of more than $20 billion, which almost certainly dwarfs the compensation any other CEO in American history has ever been paid from a company with profits not remotely commensurate with that level of compensation. The updated billionaire wealth figures come as Democrats in Congress are struggling to chart a path forward for their flagship social spending and climate legislation, which has been held up by corporate-backed Senator Joe Manchin. The House-passed version of the Build Back Better Act includes a surtax on millionaires and other measures to help fund the bill's investments and reduce out-of-control inequality. According to the Washington Post, Manchin recently told the Biden White House that he would be willing to support some version of a tax targeting billionaires, an idea that the West Virginia Democrat criticized in October. While the specifics of what Manchin would support remain unclear, Senate Finance Committee Chairman Ron Wyden has unveiled a tax aimed at the accrued wealth of America's approximately 700 billionaires, the Post noted. The measure is aimed at addressing the massive gains of the wealthiest Americans with a federal tax and probably would be unprecedented in how few people it affected. Congress nonpartisan scorekeeper has estimated it would raise as much as $550 billion over 10 years, or pay for more than one quarter of the Democrats' spending bill. In a social media post on New Year's Day, the Patriotic Millionaires, a group composed of wealthy supporters of progressive taxation, warned that history paints a bleak picture of what happens to extremely unequal societies. For the well-being of rich and poor alike, it's time to confront inequality and choose to tax the rich, the group wrote. If you don't, then all the talk at Davos won't change what's coming. It's taxes or pitchforks.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagin.
We've been discussing the effect of the Shahada of the Lady Fatima al-Zahra salamullahi alayha and her choice to be a Shahida. The last point regarding the Shahada of Fatima al-Zahra salamullahi alayha and the effect of that Shahada that we want to discuss has to do with the effect of the Shahada of Fatima al-Zahra on not the enemies and not the believers who were following her already, but on the mustadafin, on those who have not heard of Islam, on those who have not heard of the Ahlul Bayt, those who have been given misinformation regarding the Ahlul Bayt. Today as well, throughout this time, but I gave that example for that time, during the time of the Imams as well, let me make this clear as well. We have hadith from Imam As-Sadiq salamullah alayh. This whole discussion of, oh, whoever is not Shia, are they Muslim, are they not Muslim? There's a very interesting, many ahadith, but one particular one I'm referring to, Zurara ibn Ayan, one of the companions of Imam al-Baqir and Imam al-Sadiq, he has this conversation with the Imam, with his ignorance, as the Imam says, his jahl, and he was young at the time, based on his misunderstanding, he's arguing with the Imam that whoever doesn't believe in you is kafir. The Imam says, no, that's not the case. Whoever doesn't believe is not necessarily kafir. He was referring to the masses, and that's mentioned explicitly in the hadith. Massively, he said they're mustad'afin. So people are three categories. They're mu'mineen, they're kuffar, and then there's mustad'afin. People who are not kuffar, they're not rejecting, they're mustad'af. The majority at that time were mustad'af, and today as well. The majority of muslimin, in regards to, obviously in regards to Tawheed, they're believers. In regards to Ma'ad, they're believers. In regards to the Qur'an, they're believers. In regards to the Prophet, they're believers. In regards to Salah, they're believers. In regards to Hajj, in most things, they're believers. In regards to the concept of Wilayah, which is very important, it's the most important teaching, that is not being rejected deliberately, knowing God has said this, yet I'm going to disbelieve in it. No, that's not the masses. That's the leaders that know this. The masses, mustad'af. The masses who think Shias are kafir, it's because their leaders are telling them, those who do. That's not a majority, but there are some leaders that are preaching that Shia is kafir. This is not the average non-Shia. No, it's a smaller group, but even they, it's because some of the leaders that are trying to pump this based on the instructions from the great Satan, the US, and the Zionists, they're trying to do this. Anyhow, today as well, the majority of people who are not with the Imam of our time, I'll put it in that way, and that includes some Shias as well, those who are not with the Imam of our time. But regarding the concept of the Ahlul Bayt, those who do not believe in the Ahlul Bayt as we do, the majority of them are mustad'afin. Mustad'afin. They either haven't heard or what they've heard is misinformation. And knowing the effect of the shahada of Fatima to Zahra, salamullahi alayha, and shahada in general, the effect of that on the mustad'afin is important for us to know. And then we will see if Fatima to Zahra, salamullahi alayha, is the mother of shahada in Islam. There were many shuhada during the time of the Prophet, and there was Sayyid al-Shuhada during the time of the Prophet, the uncle of the Prophet. But the shahada of Fatima to Zahra, salamullah alayha, is the loneliest, most oppressed, and most oppressive form of shahada or killing that they did towards Fatima to Zahra, salamullah alayha. Not, it doesn't have to be physically done in a very painful way, which it was, that gradual process of shahada, salamullahi alayha. It's hard to imagine, but just think, it took a couple of months for the injuries to lead to her shahada. The injuries led to shahada. When did the injuries happen? Soon after the demise of the Prophet, maybe a week or two after the demise of the Prophet, those injuries occurred. And she lived for another 2 months. Those injuries got worse and worse. This is torturous. Salamullah alayki. I apologize for putting in that. I'm just trying to make a point here. Regarding her shahada, we have a long ways to before we can really understand her shahada. This form of shahada in a physical way, but not even just that. At the time of that istishhad, other than her and Amir al-Mu'mineen, no one understood the necessity of that shahada. And so a lot of people thought it was wrong. Or, if they thought well of her, they would think that, oh, it's bad that this happened to her. She chose that. It was her choice. Understanding that that shahada, as the mother of shahada and the mother of shuhada, throughout time, if shahada has this effect on the mustad'afin, and the majority of the people of the world are mustad'afin, then we will know that this is also an effective tool for us today to win over and to affect the mustad'afin. What's the effect of shahada on the mustad'afin? What's the effect of the shahada of Fatima to Zahra, salamullahi alayha, on the mustad'afin? With the shahada of Fatima to Zahra, salamullahi alayha, it's a little difficult to talk, because because of Fatima al-Zahra, salamullahi alayha, her effects are just beyond imagination. Her effects, other than Shahada and her istishhad, her martyrdom, are beyond our comprehension. There's another Shahada. Let me start with this. I think it's better to start with this. There's another Shahada in Islam that was seen more as Shahada right from the beginning. The Shahada of Fatima al-Zahra, salamullahi alayha, just like her grave, has been hidden. It hasn't been spoken of too much. It's part of her character. It's hard to sometimes even find proper accounts historically to put it together, and unfortunately that's led some people who love the Ahlul Bayt to not be able to come to the conclusion that Fatima al-Zahra was martyred. No, she was definitely martyred. But there's another Shahada in Islam that was very clear and very well known, and everyone saw it and everyone heard of it, and that is the istishhad of Imam al-Husayn salamullahi alayh. This shahada was very evident, and it was upheld, it was spoken of, it was mentioned, it was remembered, people reminded. The imams created a culture of the remembrance of that shahada. Otherwise, the istishhad of Fatima al-Zahra, for various reasons, it was hidden. Even the Ahlul Bayt, salamullah alayhim ajma'in, their crying for Fatima al-Zahra was in hiding. Not just the children of Fatima al-Zahra right after her shahada and on the night of her burial and so on and so forth. Imam al-Jawad, salamullah alayhi, as a child, Imam al-Ridha sees him crying in the house though, no majlis. And he's crying, and he asks him, "Why are you crying?" Imam al-Jawad, as a child, obviously he was 8 when Imam al-Ridha was martyred, so this was before that, probably when he was 6 or even younger. Imam al-Ridha asks, "Why are you crying?" I'm not quoting the Imam here. Something along these lines, that Imam is crying and he says, "What did my mother do to deserve this treatment?" And he's crying and crying. The crying of the Ahlul Bayt, we don't have accounts that says the Ahlul Bayt established sessions like they did for Imam al-Husayn for the Lady Fatima al-Zahra. For many reasons, this Shahada was hidden. It's only recently that this is coming into light, and there's more open majalis, more. And recently doesn't mean in the last few years, the last couple of decades or so. But it's recent. It's after the time of the presence of the Ahlul Bayt that this became an event that is commemorated. Anyhow, that other shahada is the shahada of Imam al-Husayn. Let's talk about this a little bit. Let's start with this. And since he's Sayyidu al-Shuhada, this effect of shahada. The effect of the shahada of Imam al-Husayn was that the Mustada'afin woke up from their sleep. Those who thought Yazid was telling them the truth here. In Sham, people were affected by the words of Muawiyah and then Yazid. This event woke them up. That's why Yazid had to do what? Yazid had to respectfully send them to wherever the Ahlul Bayt wanted. We've discussed this over and over. Who were the people that were affected by that istishhad and hearing of that shahada and the martyrdom? And the Lady Zainab bringing them that news before Yazid twists that truth. But it's the shahada that has that effect. It's the mustada'afin that are affected. The mustada'afin come to know what the truth is. The mustada'afin start realizing, oh, it's not what we thought. This is the effect of shahada.
لك يا مولاتي نشأت كلماتي يا وسيلتنا وشفيعتنا فاطم الزهراء
لك يا مولاتي نشأت كلماتي يا وسيلتنا
شفيعة لفاطم الزهراء يا وسيلتنا وشفيعة لفاطم الزهراء
فاطم الزهراء
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The non-profit environmental working group, EWG, estimates that drinking water for more than 170 million Americans in all 50 states contains radioactive elements at levels that may increase the risk of cancer. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Lynn Peoples, journalist. This article is published under the heading Radioactive Contamination is Creeping into Drinking Water Around the U.S. Stay tuned for more. When Jenny Knack moved to Simi Valley, California in 2018, she had no idea that her family's new home was within 5 miles of a former nuclear and rocket testing lab, perched atop a plateau and rife with contamination. Radioactive cesium-137, strontium-90, plutonium-239 and tritium, along with a mix of other toxic chemicals and heavy metals, are known to have been released at the industrial site through various spills, leaks, and the use of open-air burn pits and a partial nuclear meltdown. Once Knack learned about the Santa Susana Field Lab and the unusual number of childhood cancer cases in the surrounding community, she couldn't ignore it. Her family now only drinks water from a 5-gallon, 19-liter jug delivered by Sparklets Water Service. In August, she began sending her 6-year-old daughter to kindergarten with 2 bottles of the water and instructions to not refill them at school, which is connected to the same Golden State Water Company that serves her home. A federal report in 2007 acknowledged that 2 wells sourced by the water company were at risk of contamination from the site. The EPA has said, "We are at risk," says Knack. And Golden State, she says, has at times used possibly a very hefty portion of that well water. To date, radioactivity above the natural level has not been detected in Golden State water. All water contains some level of radiation. The amount and type can vary significantly. Production of nuclear weapons and energy from material is one potential source. Mining for uranium is another. Radioactive elements can be introduced into water via medical treatments, including radioactive iodine used to treat thyroid disorders. And it can be unearthed during oil and gas drilling or any industrial activities that involve cracking into bedrock, where radioactive elements naturally exist. What's more, because of their natural presence, these elements can occasionally seep into aquifers even without being provoked. The nonprofit environmental working group, EWG, estimates that drinking water for more than 170 million Americans in all 50 states contains radioactive elements at levels that may increase the risk of cancer. In their analysis of public water system data collected between 2010 and 2015, EWG focused on six radioactive contaminants, including radium, radon, and uranium. They found that California has more residents affected by radiation in their drinking water than anywhere else in the U.S., yet the state is far from alone. About 80% of Texans are served by water utilities reporting detectable levels of radium. And concerns have echoed across the U.S., from abandoned uranium mines on Navajo Nation lands to lingering nuclear waste from the Manhattan Project in Missouri to contaminants leaching from phosphate mines in Florida. While ingesting radioactive elements through drinking contaminated water is not the only route of human exposure, it is a major risk pathway, says Daniel Hirsch, a retired University of California Santa Cruz professor who has studied the Santa Susana Field lab contamination. One thing you don't want to do is to mix radioactivity with water. It's an easy mechanism to get it inside people, he says. When you drink water, you think you exert it. But body is made to extract things from what you ingest, he said. Strontium-90, for example, is among elements that mimic calcium, so the body is apt to concentrate the contaminant in bones, raising the risk of leukemia. Pregnant women and young kids are especially vulnerable because greater amounts of radiation are deposited in rapidly growing tissue and bones. This is why pregnant women are never X-rayed, says Catherine Thomason, an independent environmental policy consultant based in Portland, Oregon. CCM can deposit in pancreas, heart, and other tissues, she notes. There, it may continue to emit radioactivity over time, causing disease and damage. Scientists believe that no amount of radiation is safe. At high levels, the radiation produced by radioactive elements can trigger birth defects, impair development, and cause cancer in almost any part of the body. An early life exposure means a long period of time for damage to develop. Health advocates express concern that the U.S. government is not doing enough to protect the public from these and other risks associated with exposure to radioactive contamination in drinking water. The legal limits set by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, for several types of radioactive elements in community water systems have not been updated since 1976. Further, many elements are regulated as a group rather than individually, such as radium-226 plus radium-228. And water system operates if they are required to monitor for radioactive elements, only need to do so infrequently, say every 6 or 9 years for certain contaminants. Meanwhile, private wells generally remain unregulated with regard to the elements, which is particularly concerning because some nuclear power plants are located in rural areas where people depend on private wells. More than one out of every 10 Americans use private wells or tiny water systems that serve fewer than 15 residences. The Santa Susana Field Lab was rural when it was first put to use about 70 years ago. Today, more than 700,000 people live within 10 miles, that is 16 kilometers. Recent wildfires have exacerbated these residents' concerns. The 2018 Woosley fire started on the property and burned 80% of its 2,850 acres. Over the following 3 months, the levels of chemical and radioactive contamination running off the site exceeded the state safety standards 57 times. Hirsch highlighted several potential avenues for drinking water contamination related to nuclear weapons or energy development. Wind can send contamination off-site and deposit it into the soil. For example, gravity can carry contaminants downhill, and rains can carry contamination via streams and rivers to infiltrate groundwater aquifers. While vegetation absorbs radioactive and chemical contaminants from the soil in which it grows, those pollutants are readily released into the environment during a fire.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio by your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ayatollah Khamenei, Lady Fatima was an ocean of wisdom and piety. July the 5th, 2007. Fatima al-Zahra, Salamullah alayha, is superior to all great and saintly women throughout history. What factors, forces, and what kind of inner strength could make a person become such an ocean of wisdom, piety, sanctity, and spiritual transcendence in such a short time? This is a miracle of Islam. The love of Fatima al-Zahra, salamullah alayha, also known as Siddiqatul Kubra, is a great blessing for us. In her short life, Fatima al-Zahra, salamullah alayha, achieved the position of the mistress of all women. In other words, she is superior to all great and saintly women throughout history. What factors, forces, and what kind of inner strength could make a person become such an ocean of wisdom, piety, sanctity, and spiritual transcendence in such a short time? Well, this is a miracle of Islam. Another point is the blessed descendants of this great person. The association of Suratul Kawthar with Fatimatul Zahra, even if such an association had not existed in our hadith collections, is an accurate association. There are so many blessings that have been bestowed on the Holy Prophet's household and on each and every one of the Imams, alayhim as-salam.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The world is full of enjoyable individual, social, worldly and otherworldly melodies which came out of the pure throats of the Imams, alayhim as-salam, Husayn ibn Ali, Zainab al-Kubra, Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba, Imam Sadiq, Imam Sajjad, and each and every one of the Imams, alayhim as-salam, would produce these melodies. See what a great excitement exists in the world of spirituality and in the path of guidance because of the words of these great personalities and their lessons and teachings. They are the children of Fatimah al-Zahra, alayha salam. We should sincerely thank God. A number of the poems which are recited by the friends contained this point. The love of Fatimah al-Zahra, alayha salam, also known as Siddiqatul Kubra, is a great blessing for us. Thank God we became familiar with her. Thank God we relied on her kindness, and thank God we appreciated her value. Thank God we relied on her, asked her to help us gain an understanding of things, and expressed our love for her. These are great blessings. We should preserve these blessings. That was the leader's speech from July the 5th, 2007.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me. Through all my years I've been lost, you guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed you gave me hope. Oh Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.